Welcome to Behind the Story, a program where we take you straight to the source. Earlier this week, former Democratic U.S. Representative Chet Edwards released his congressional papers to the Baylor Collections of Political Materials. In this episode, we'll talk with Edwards and Debbie Davendonis Todd, an archivist with the Baylor Collections Political Materials. This is Behind the Story.
Thank you both for talking with KWBU today.
It's great to be here, Carlos. Thank you.
To start off, Chet, I want to talk a little bit about your political career. You've said that you've hoped these archives, you know, your congressional papers would inspire a new generation and give a window into bipartisan cooperation, which, of course, you are a Democrat who won in and represented a largely Republican constituency. With that in mind, was there a model of that for you when you first started your career in politics?
Well, I think my models were Congressman Olin Teague, who represented the College Station area and much of Central Texas, and Congressman Pogue. They came from an era where what they were motivated to do is to work with people across the aisle to do the right thing for our country, whether it was in Mr. Pogue's era, fighting the Great Depression and World War II, or whether it was trying to, you know, strengthen America as a leader in this world and see that we did not have another World War II, whether it was working to strengthen our economy in times of recession, or fighting for their districts. They came from an era of bipartisanship, and I'm a student of that era, and I know we're going through an era today in American politics where there is so much harsh partisanship, and I don't know when that's going to turn around, but I have confidence that we the people will ultimately encourage our elected officials to cross party lines, to compromise, to work together for the good of the country.
And, you know, it's that that harsh partisanship that I wanted to ask you about. You know, the bipartisan work and collaboration that really highlighted your career seems to be, you know, like you just said, increasingly difficult to accomplish these days, especially, you know, given the current political climate. So how was it that, you know, you were able to accomplish bipartisan cooperation? I can assume it wasn't easy at times.
Well, it wasn't easy, but you realize that we would not be a country today had our founding fathers not been willing to compromise. The fact that there is a House and a Senate was a compromise by our founding fathers between those that came from more populated areas that just wanted a House of Representatives and those that came from more rural areas that wanted a Senate. They compromised, and now we have a democracy that served our nation well for over two centuries. The fact that the nation's capital is in Washington, D.C., and not Philadelphia or New York, was itself a compromise between northern legislators and southern legislators in our earliest years. So compromise is just, some think it's a four-letter word. Actually, it's the foundation of our democracy. And you know, if you think about it, it's only in a dictatorship that anyone gets everything he or she wants, and that's only if you're lucky enough to be the dictator. In a democracy, we should celebrate differences of opinions. We should celebrate that we have different political parties that represent different ideologies. But once elections are over, then we need to come together to address issues today, such as our $18 trillion national debt, such as what is America's role in the world.
Now, specifically looking at your decades-long career, is there a moment of bipartisan cooperation that stands out to you as kind of the a hallmark of your time?
I think the fact that we started in 1992, my second year in Congress, with the largest deficits in American history, at that time $292 billion a year, and before the end of the decade ended up with a balanced budget, was to a large degree an example of Democrats and Republicans working together. And it was a moment I was so proud of. The first time we were bringing in more revenues to the federal government than we were paying out in expenses. I could look at my children and feel good that we are preserving their future. But with bipartisanship breaking down, Republicans not even wanting to mention the tax word, Democrats not wanting to cut in any way entitlement programs, you end up with a situation we now have, instead of a predicted zero national debt by 2010, here we are in 2016 with an $18 trillion national debt. That's about $40,000 to $50,000 of debt for every family of four. It's about $40,000 to $50,000 in debt on a pro rata basis for every man, woman, and child and baby in the United States. So it means about every family of four has about $200,000 debt is their pro rata share of the national debt. Well, what happens when you borrow money? You got to pay it back, and you not only have to pay back the principal, you got to pay back with interest. And so on issues such as strengthening our economy in a very competitive world and balancing the federal budget, reducing the national debt, those things just won't happen without compromise. I was part of a group for 2 years that had a bipartisan agreement, 10 Republicans or 5 Republicans, 5 Democrats in the House. We worked for 2 years, built trust, met 30 times. Not one reporter knew we'd met. We had a compromise on immigration reform that some of the most conservative Republicans in the House were signing off on and some of the most liberal Democrats were signing off on. And we did it because we built up trust over that two-year period. Unfortunately, just as we were about to introduce the legislation to the country and to the Congress, the anti-immigration laws hit in Arizona, and the issue became such a hot potato that my Republican colleagues, understandably, disappointingly but understandably, had to back off from that compromise.
And now, looking at your nearly 30 years as a state and federal legislator, some of your work, actually a good amount of your work, especially here in the Waco area, Central Texas area, has revolved around Veterans Affairs.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about your work with Veterans Affairs and if there's any effort that you may have pushed or led the charge in that really kind of stands above the rest for you?
Right. Carlos, thanks for asking that. I had the incredible honor. In fact, I have had no greater privilege in my lifetime than to represent the largest Army installation in the world, Fort Hood, Texas, and two VA hospitals here in Waco and the one in Temple. And it became a passion for me to try to give something back to the men and women who put on our nation's uniform, defended our country, and made great sacrifices in the process. I would say up front that no matter what I tried to do, I always understood that I could never give back to them as much as they could give to me. But during that time period, working with other people of good faith on a bipartisan basis, we were able to add over $1 billion in improvements for Fort Hood. That meant better housing and child care and facilities. It meant a joint use airport that was important to the United States Army in the Killeen area. We helped create a new state veterans cemetery in the Fort Hood area. But I later became chairman of the VA and Military Construction Appropriations Subcommittee that had about a $100 billion a year budget. And in that, we helped pass some of the largest increases for veterans health care in our country's history. And I hope as a consequence of that, there are thousands of veterans that receive better care than they would have otherwise. I think emotionally, the effort that has meant more to me than anything else in my 20 years in the Congress was to author and pass the Marine Gunnery Sergeant John David Frye scholarship law. John David Frye was born and raised, went to high school in Lorena. He was a husband, father of 3 children under the age of 10 when he was in Iraq in the Second Iraq War. And he was 7 days away from coming home. His bags were packed. He'd finished all of his work. He didn't have to do anything else. He'd done what our country had asked him to do, which, by the way, he'd volunteered for one of the most dangerous jobs there in that combat situation, to go out and defuse literally dozens and dozens of improvised explosive devices, IEDs, that were buried in roads and killing so many of our American troops. 7 days before Sergeant Frye was going to come home to his wife and his 3 children, a call came in from Al Anbar province that there were some three IEDs buried there, and he didn't have to go out there. His work was done, but he raised his hand and volunteered and went out and said, "I can do this better than some new soldier or Marine." And he got to the third IED and had no way of knowing it was booby-trapped. And so when he defused the third IED, the fourth one exploded and it killed him. Sergeant Fry gave his life that night, 1 week before coming home to his family, when he didn't have to. And when we dedicated the post office, Lorena, in his name and his honor, I looked at those three children and said, surely our country can do more for a family like this than to just rename a post office, even though that was well intentioned. And so I wrote the law, named it after him, that provides a full college scholarship. It includes funding for books and housing allowance for every son and daughter in America, every military child in America who's lost a mom or dad in service to country. And I told my wife when President Obama signed that into law that, just for the record, if a Mack truck ran over me the next day, I wanted her to know that every tough campaign we went through was worth it just to be able to pass that one bill into law. Who could be more deserving in our country than the children of military servicemen and women, the children who lost a mother or father in service to country?
Now, I'd like to shift gears a little bit from your time in serving,
right?
To talk about the archives specifically. So I want to start off with still asking you, but why Baylor? Why Waco for this archive?
Well, I moved to Waco 34 years ago, and this community and Baylor have had a profound influence on my life. It is my home. It is where I met my wife, Leanne, whose father used to be pastor of First Baptist Church here. It's where our two sons, JT and Garrison, were born. In 1982, when I won my state Senate race as an upset candidate, an election that surprised a lot of people, had it not been for the wonderful families of Waco, McLennan County, I never would have won that election. So I've had a love affair with Waco for over three decades, and Baylor is part of the heart and soul of this community, and it was always such an honor to represent this great university that ultimately that was an easy choice for me to make.
You know, the collection fills 341 boxes and
right.
818 speeches, the majority of which were handwritten,
yes.
which you wrote by hand. So it kind of made me wonder, did you save all these documents and paperwork as keepsakes, or did you ever have the idea that maybe this was something you'd like to either donate or give back and preserve as historical right. documents?
I always felt that those papers didn't belong to me. They belonged to the people of Waco and in Central Texas. And I was also encouraged by Ben Rogers, who is the former director of the Pogue Library, to think about preserving the papers. And Ben is one of the reasons that our papers are at Baylor now. He dedicated his life to the Pogue Library and the Baylor collection of political materials. But I just felt that these weren't mine to throw away. These were papers that belonged to the people who gave me the privilege to represent them in the Texas Senate for 8 years and in the U.S. Congress for 20 years.
And now, Debbie, as an archivist, you must love to receive a real treasure trove of documents like this. But it's also got to be a little daunting, in a sense, to have to comb through.
It is. I think political collections sort of epitomize the challenges of a modern collection because they are so large. They tend to be complex. There's a variety of formats that you can encounter. I've heard it sort of described as an embarrassment of riches, if you will, because who wouldn't want this sort of facts on the ground perspective on all of these local to national issues? And then the flip side of that is, how do we prepare this for use and for future researchers? So our mission is sort of twofold. We're thinking part One, preservation. And part two, inspiration. We preserve these records to be used for the future. We don't want to weigh into guiding what might come out of it, but we really want to provide that opportunity for people to study this intersection of we the people and government. And that's a mission that's near and dear to the Pogue, but also to me personally. And I think in particular with Chet, we've had a real wonderful opportunity to sort of work side by side with him in working with the papers. And that's not something that always happens. Sometimes a donor has passed on and the family is now just turning over the papers. So to work with Chet as we kind of go through this process, if we had a question or little things like, can you read this handwriting? We cannot. What were you thinking at that moment in time? We can't understand you. To bigger things, to say, you know, Chet, could you maybe sit down and do an oral history interview with us to provide another layer, another perspective, to kind of bring out how did this memo come about and that sort of thing. So it's great. And then it's almost as if his public service career continues to evolve, and working with him as our chair for public service to interact with current students and to take that to the next level and inspiring future leaders.
Now, Carlos, in short, what I can say is they took chaos and turned it into order. this massive amount of papers, and we didn't think through how to organize this in a way that researchers could use, but just dump that at the Pogue Library, and Debbie and her team have just done a magnificent job of organizing those papers. And I would say, and I'd really want to emphasize this, these papers aren't about Chet Edwards. They're not about me. They're about the people of this district. They're about the politics and history of our community, the fight alongside our community to save the Waco VA hospital or to raise the lake level of Lake Waco for our water supply in Central Texas, or to fight to build a new terminal at the airport. So when President Bush was in the White House, we didn't look like a backwards, early 1900s airport, which was important for the image of Waco, and fighting for Fort Hood, which is so important as part of our national security. You know, that in the Bob Pogue papers, here's a congressman who represented us in Congress for over 40 years. And think about the richness of his papers. Went through the last years of the Great Depression, World War II, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, chairman of the Agriculture Committee, with that industry being so important to Central Texas. Played a key role in having Fort Hood located in Killeen. And so this collection, far beyond mine, is a treasure trove of insights into the history of Central Texas. Why? You know, what would Waco be like today without Lake Waco, for example? How did that happen? How important was General Tire, which is now a 21st century research institute for Baylor? That came from the efforts of Congressman Pogue. Marvin Leith brought the Army Air Force Exchange jobs, hundreds of jobs to Waco, and beat in a political fight for that the majority leader of the U.S. House of Representatives, Jim Wright of Fort Worth. An amazing story. So I think for anybody that has an interest in history and our community and our state and country, these collections, the 13 congressional collections and the state collections, are just a goldmine of insights. And ultimately, my hope is this. I've always respected what the Spanish-born philosopher George Santayana said, that those who don't understand history are doomed to repeat it. You know, hidden in those thousands and thousands of documents are insights into the mistakes our country's made in the past. And those who can learn from that can perhaps, help make us a more perfect union and keep us from repeating those same mistakes. So much of history repeats itself, even though each generation thinks we're the first to break new ground. And so I think history can be interesting in and of itself, but it can also be a tool to helping us be a more perfect union, to being a better community, to understanding our past and to better shape our future.
Absolutely. And I think, too, so when you look at our file folder, say you pull a box off the shelf, you really do get this sort of snapshot based on what's written on these folders and contained within them of who we are as a country at a moment in time. And I think it was James Madison who said that an informed citizenry was the best way that this experiment in representative democracy will survive. And so we really want to encourage that research and that exploration of the process. And I think sometimes people say, why study Congress? Or so often, you know, all this politics is the butt of jokes. But we say this stuff really matters. And it shows that within our folders, within our boxes. And you can really get a sense of that when you come and you study and you learn. And I think, too, there's a variety of disciplines that this type of material can serve. Absolutely history, absolutely political science, but sociology, healthcare, education, these issues are enduring. Transportation, all sorts of different areas that you might not have initially thought of. And say, no, actually, we have something on that. So I say Baylor Collections of Political Materials, we have something for everyone.
There you go. So. And when we're talking about like processing, you know, we're talking about getting these ready for your researchers. Can you take me a little bit into that? That process from
Absolutely.
Receiving the material
that's
to
right.
to getting it ready. I mean,
sure.
That's got to take years.
You know, it depends. It definitely is a process, and we want to do due diligence to the material, because one thing that's so important, a part of archives, is the context in which something was created. And so we spend a lot of time preparing sort of background information, you know, who was the member, what issues were important, near and dear to their heart, what was happening in the country at that time. So you kind of have this background to kind of go on, and then you get the boxes, and then you can kind of dive in. And so you're looking at, okay, how can we best arrange this material for a researcher, because it's really important to remember that a member of Congress and their staff are very task-oriented, as they should be. I mean, they're doing the people's work, the people's business, so they're not thinking, oh, well, I'm going to file this with a clearly labeled folder that's got an exact date on it, and it's ready to roll. That doesn't really happen. And if you do file like that, that's awesome. We love it. But so we take that, and typically we start with sort of a big sort of umbrella, say to a Congress. So okay. What's happening within this particular Congress, and we're going to put all of that material together. And then we take it down a level, what we call series, and we can arrange those by date. It could be by topic or maybe function of the office, say administrative material. So anything that helps the office function, schedules, letterhead, envelopes, all those sorts of things, basic routine constituent requests and stuff. That's sort of the administrative material. And then you have sort of another large basket, the legislative material. And that's where you can kind of get into the nitty-gritty of, you know, this topical A to Z list of all these things that the member and the staff has been working on. So once we decide sort of how we're going to, which sort of baskets, different things, or piles, if you will,
sure.
We do lots of piles, where things go and moving this box over here, we then prepare a box listing. So we have, you know, clear folder titles, clear dates for researchers, and then we prepare a larger, what's called a scope and content note, and series descriptions, and that's going to let the researcher know, okay, in the administrative series from 1990 to 2001, you can find the following types of materials. There's correspondence, there's schedules, whatever it might entail. And that's helpful to a researcher, because if I'm coming in and I want to study Chet's schedules, oh, that keyword, boom, I'm going to go right to those set of boxes, because when you have 300 plus boxes, you kind of need to know where to hone in on.
Okay.
And so then with that description, you prepare a finding aid, and all of that goes into this. So you have a biographical sketch. So for Chet, we would have sort of who he is, his story. And then you have a collection scope and content note. So this collection represents, you know, 2 decades of service in the U.S. House of Representatives. Major topics include religious liberty, veterans affairs, and so on. And that's kind of the one-stop shopping for a researcher to say, yes, this is the collection I want to use, or this is intriguing. I want to check out these boxes. What was Chet talking about with religious liberty? So it's just kind of an introduction and a little index, if you will.
And real quickly, Chet, I'd like to ask if you could talk a little bit about your time teaching here. I understand that you do that and just what that means and how that kind of relates to all the work you've done beforehand.
Well, the last 5 years have been a wonderful new chapter in my life, being able to teach at Baylor. I teach 2 weeks each semester, so I come in for 1 week. Probably do 7 to 9 lectures a week and then meet with student leaders. And the bottom line is I'm learning more from the students than they're probably learning from me. And for those that are cynical about the future of this country, and there are many cynics out there these days, I'd say come get to know these Baylor students and you'll feel good about our country's future. They're bright. They care. They very much want to pursue careers that allow them to make a difference, a positive difference in our community and in our country. And I'll teach at the law school, the religion department, the seminary, the School of Social Work, any class or course that might be influenced by public policy, which is almost
every
good or
course.
Bad, is almost everything these days. And you know, my hope is that students seem to enjoy hearing firsthand stories from someone who was in the political arena. Just as if they're a business student, they love to hear from an entrepreneur or a CEO or president of a company. So in a way, this is my continuation of public service. It's, you know, at the end of the day, public service is just trying to make a small difference in this world. And my faith in the civil rights movement motivated me to get into public service. And so teaching at Baylor, while it's not an elected position, is just one way I can add an extra chapter in my life to try to give something back. Because I'm so grateful to all of the people who mentored me throughout life. B. Rappaport, Congressman Pogue, Congressman Teague, my parents, my next-door neighbor Lou Collins, who was like a second father to me. And I just, as I've gotten older, I realize that there are no self-made people in this world. We've all been influenced by mentors, either family or friends or teachers. And so I feel an obligation to try to give something back. And if I can just encourage one Baylor student to realize that government isn't an evil institution. It's an imperfect institution, but a very important part of our society and our culture and who we are as a nation. And by the way, at the end of the day, despite the problems and the partisanship in Washington, all is not broken in our political system, Carlos. If you think about our immigration problem, is it that millions of Americans are lining up at our border to leave our country and never come back because things are so bad here? Absolutely. That's not the case. Just the opposite. We still have, because of our Constitution and our democracy and our free enterprise system, we still have more freedoms and opportunities than people could even dream about in most parts of the world. And so as long as our immigration problem is more people are trying to come to our country than leave it, then all is not lost in our democracy.
That was former U.S. Representative Chet Edwards and Debbie Davendonis Todd, the Bob Bullock archivist at the Baylor Collections of Political Materials. To hear this episode and past episodes of Behind the Story, you can visit our website at kwbu.org.